Happy Endings by Wind Rider, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Niall was introduced to Joe and Nikki like they are two halves of a whole. "That's Booker," Andy had said, pointing the man out with one finger jabbed in his direction. "And this is Joe and Nikki." She had lumped their names together as one. They'd been on opposite sides of the room, Joe reading and Nikki cooking, but even despite the distance between them, their names were conjoined, Joe and Nikki, a single solitary unit split into two bodies. Admittedly, Niall doesn't have much time to think much on their relationship during that first day. Explosions, kidnappings, betrayal, and murder had a tendency to distract. There are things that Niall remembers and observes, of course. "The love of my life," Nikki had said of Joe. Joe's answering wink, the way they slept, curled around each other, like if they could meld into each other's bodies, they would. In the lab, during the fight, Niall barely knew what was happening at any given moment, but she knew those two were almost always together, no matter what. She accepted it as fact. It's in the escape vehicle where things feel like they change. She's surprised that Joe sits up front with Andy and not in the back with Nikki, but Niall and Booker bookend the man into the middle seat, and he politely tucks his legs in as much as he can as Andy drives them out of London. Nikki is a bloody mess. "Not as bad as me," she thinks. Then, "It's not a goddamn competition." Either way, as an objective observation, Nikki is a mess. He's uninjured as far as Niall can tell. Unlike Andy, his wounds have all healed, but there's dried blood smeared along the back of his head, and he keeps reaching a hand up to scratch at it as it flakes through his hair. They're all a bit battered and disreputable, but from an outside perspective, Niall can't help but wince at the amount of gore that's accumulated back there. They don't have anything to wash it off with. She wishes they did. "What happened?" she asked. "I didn't see that happen." He glances at her, shrugging. When he opens his mouth to speak, Joe interrupts from the front. "Keen put his gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger," Joe spits out. Nikki winces, then glances up at Joe. From this angle, they can just see his eyes in the rear view. On Nikki's other side, Booker has taken to staring at him with something akin to horror. It seems a bit like an odd reaction considering their lives. "Andy shot me in the head when we first met," she offers awkwardly. Nikki smiles. He smiles and pats her hand, where it rests on her knee. "Andy is not very nice at times." "I'm nicer than anyone you know," Andy grunts from up front. Niall can hear the pain in her voice. "Should you be driving?" she asks. Every single person in the car offers their opinion to that question. All of them disagree with Andy's self-made assessment that she's fine. The next chance they get to stop and switch, Joe takes the wheel, and Andy stretches out in the passenger seat. Niall yawns, hiding it behind her wrist. "Get some rest," Nikki tells her gently. "We can wake you when we arrive." "You're always trying to get me to sleep," Niall complains. She curls against the car door anyway, and he pats her knee again. "It is good to rest," he murmurs. She's asleep before she has time to think about anything else. It's been a long fucking week. They do, in fact, wake her up nearly 30 minutes later. They brought her to a safe house that looks tasteful and modern, and she weeps at the idea of getting a shower or a bath. There are two fully equipped bathrooms just for that purpose, too. Everyone agrees to take turns getting cleaned up, but they shuffle her and Andy into the bathrooms first, and Niall is too gross to complain. She washes her hair as best she can, thinking about how she'll need to undo her braids to get at everything properly. She lathers up and soaks and turns her hands this way and that, expecting her injuries to somehow reappear, but accepting that they won't. She leaves the bathroom after soaking for so long she's turned properly pruney. They had all insisted she take her time, and she had. She'd needed it. Booker is nowhere to be seen, but Andy is on a large sofa dressed in a soft shirt that's too big for her and some plaid sleep pants that look divine. Someone had left a similar set of clothes out for Niall, and she'd already snuggled right in. "Whoever picked the clothes did a great job," she announces. Andy smiles at her, a little crooked, but still immeasurably fond. "That'll be Nicky," she says. "He has a knack for that kind of thing." Niall sits next to the boss, immortal, and gets comfortable. "Where is the man of the hour, then? Shower?" "Yeah. He and Joe took over when they were done patching me up. It might be a while before they get out. Don't hold your breath. Wasn't planning on it." It'll keep until morning. She doesn't need to track the man down and offer her thanks in person. "How are you feeling?" she asks. "Sore," Andy admits. "Sore and tired and really fucking old, to be honest." She sighs. All of that sounds perfectly reasonable to Niall. She tells her so, too. Andy's lips quirk a bit at the corners. "You know, I looked after those two idiots for nearly 1,000 years. She pauses, then says, "Booker, too, when he came around. Though I did a worse job with him." One of her hands shifts a little. It's a subtle movement, but her palm rests over the bullet wound that Booker had given her. "It was my job to worry about everyone else. And then today, for the first time, they're all worried about me." "They love you," Niall tells her. Andy nods. She knows it's true, and she isn't trying to deny it. "You know, the first time I met Joe and Nicky, it wasn't as smooth as when you and I met." "You think our meeting was smooth?" Niall asks, aghast. "Compared to them?" "Yeah. It turned into a four-way free-for-all after a while," Andy laughs. It's obviously a bit too much strain on her side, because she hisses not long after. She settles again, but the smile doesn't shift from her lips. "Quinn was with me, and somehow or other the boys got it in their head that we were going to hurt them. Yusuf stabbed me mid-explanation, and then Quinn stabbed him, and then Nicola was stabbing both of us." "Those are their real names?" Niall asks. It's the first she's heard of them. Andy blinks as if she didn't realize the slip, but her expression shifts to something immeasurably fond after that. "Yeah. Yusuf Alkazani and Nicolo De Genova. They're beautiful names, poetic even. Niall thinks she likes them better than Joe and Nicky, but there's a kind of portmanteau nest with Joe and Nicky that rolls off the tongue. Far better than Yusuf and Nicolo. Huh. Nico Joe," she snorts. "After we had all died a few times," Andy goes on, oblivious, "Quinn landed a bad shot that caught Nicolo right across the face. It tore through his cheek here." Andy drew a line from her ear to the corner of her lips. "It didn't kill him, and he spent the next few minutes coughing on blood while Yusuf tried to get him to breathe. Then Yusuf spent the next 10 minutes screaming at us. By that point, we put our weapons down and tried to start the whole talking part all over again. It worked better the second time around." "So they weren't already a thing when you met?" Niall asks. She doesn't really know what to say. Andy nods. She groans and stretches a little, tossing her legs up on the kitschy coffee table in front of the sofa. Her head lolls back onto a cushion. "Talk about a slow burn. Imagine watching the pair of them dancing around each other for a decade," Andy whines. Niall thinks about it. She can't really help it either. She smiles. "It sounds sweet," she says. A door opens down the hall, and she thinks she can hear the men in question speaking to each other. Andy scoffs. Nicola had convinced himself that the dreams meant that we were somehow their soulmates, and that we had a divine obligation to procreate. That sounds far less sweet, in Niall's opinion. "Yes," Joe confirms, meandering over one weary step at a time. "The light of my life had already packed his little rucksack to go, ready to wed himself to this heathen in order to produce the children God asked of him." "That's not true," Nikki mutters over Joe's shoulder. I didn't say I would marry them. No, no, you implied it often enough. There's a glimmer in Joe's eye as he says it. This is a joke they've shared many times before, it seems. Nikki sniffs indignantly and crosses his arms over his chest. He looks better without the blood sloshing down from his hair like a bad Halloween costume. Both of them look better, in fact. Good shower? Niall asks, a bit pointlessly. Yes, thank you, Nikki replies. He is, as always, the most polite of the lot. How are you feeling? Better, she confirms. Weird, she admits after, because she didn't know how else to describe the strange, otherworldly kind of disconnect that comes with realizing you can throw yourself out of a building, splat on the ground in pieces, and then become reformed, healthy and whole, only moments later. It will pass, Nikki says. It takes time, but it will pass. How long did it take you? She asks. Nikki meets Joe's eyes. There's something strange about the look he's giving Joe. She can't describe it. She supposes when you spend 1,000 years with someone that there must be an endless amount of emotions that defy rational human understanding. His expression is simultaneously happy and sad, fond and uncertain, hopeful and resigned. He is an oxymoron trapped in the body of a kindly Italian man who looks 30-something, but is in fact far, far older. 11 years, he replies softly. Joe takes Nikki's hand in his. They're a truly beautiful couple. She looks at them and thinks, I wonder if I'll ever find someone like that. She hopes she does. It would be nice. Booker is exiled for 100 years. Niall didn't quite understand the crux of many of the arguments being made. Joe had been furious about Nikki getting shot in particular, as if the brief stint of medical torture had been secondary to the temporary and immediately corrected cruelty of a mercenary. Neither Andy nor Nikki seemed particularly surprised by Joe's irritation, though, and Niall didn't want to seem insensitive by asking for clarification on a topic that clearly worked Joe up whenever it was raised. Booker accepts his punishment with calm acceptance. They turn their backs on him and walk away, Joe taking up the rear. Niall is a bit cognizant of how Joe keeps looking over his shoulder. What is it? She asks him. He's the one who pushed for a century. If he's guilty about it now, that train had already left the station. Nothing, Joe replies, then wincing, still trying to come to terms with it all. You have 100 years for that, she tells him. She's a little bitter that Booker's been exiled, in truth. His betrayal hadn't struck her as hard as it had struck the others, and when she thinks of him, she only thinks of his kind words and his gentle truths that guided her to her own sense of purpose. He'd been different from Andy, who expected everyone to just fall into lockstep at a moment's notice. Niall can see that kind of thing, well ingrained in both Joe and Nikki, who answer Andy's orders with brutal efficiency. There's a reason, Niall thinks, that Andy tends to call them her boys, where Booker is not quite included in that statement. There's a reason, too, for why Booker felt so excluded. Booker had been brutally honest from the start with everything except his intentions to commit suicide in the least acceptable way possible. Niall doubts that leaving him alone is going to make any of it better for anyone. But that's the bed they've all made. Not really, Joe sighs. What does that mean? We'd never keep Andy from him now that she's actually dying, Joe says. It won't be 100 years of exile. Does he know that? Andy will have told him. And when was I going to find out? He seems genuinely confused by her frustration. Now? He offers awkwardly. She scowls. Would have been nice to know that, she says. Joe nods, apologizes. She doesn't really want to hear it, though. She stuffs her hands into her pockets and tries to figure out what the punishment actually means in the long run, how it will be enforced. A lighter punishment is exactly what Niall had wanted, but hearing that it's a de facto lighter sentence feels wrong in some way. One you know you can depend on. 100 years, hard stop, clear and concise. But to give someone hope that maybe this year is the year it gets better, with no actual plan in place beyond less than 100, seems cruel. They get back to the car, and everyone shuffles in and prepares to leave for Copley's. Nikki and Joe share a look that Niall doesn't feel like interpreting. She gets into the passenger seat while Joe slides into the back. Andy drives. Nikki, Niall found, never drives. He doesn't like it, apparently, and would much prefer to be chauffeured around by his family. No one really talks much as they make their way to the other party in this betrayal game. Copley welcomes them inside with a quick sweep of his arms, and they all clamber up into the weird stalker room of graphs and pictures and maps. Niall has seen what there is to see, so she settles into the arm of a sofa and watches the others investigate the board. Joe and Nikki trace their names and dates and pictures. They stand, shoulder to shoulder, leaning forward to explore the roadmap of their lives together. Andy is left just taking it all in. Because everything that Joe and Nikki did could be traced back to her, really. She's the one who guided them and brought them together as this team. She's the one who led them and gave them an opportunity to do more. Niall wants to know that part of the story now more than ever. It's not a story that Copley needs to hear, though, so she waits. She waits until the others are properly satisfied and they turn to face Copley to pass their judgment. It's a simple thing. The starting of this new phase of their group. Niall feels strangely a part of this system. She's grateful to be a part of it, in truth. Copley offers them to spend the night at his place, but they turn it down for yet another safe house that apparently they have not far away. How many do you have? Niall asks. It's easy to collect properties when you live forever, Andy suggests. There's a housing crisis going on. We rent them out a lot if we know we won't be there for a while, Nikki says calmly. What would you like for dinner? He's opening and closing cabinets, seeing what they have. A burger. Nikki hesitates for a moment, and she wonders if she's offended his Italian sensibilities at the suggestion. But then he's nodding along and drawing up a list of ingredients that they need to get from the store. Joe runs out to the market to get the supplies, while Nikki cleans and sorts the kitchen so it's in good working order by the time Joe returns. There's a grill out back, and Nikki scrubs excess charcoal off with an old grill brush that's seen better days. He organizes the plates and cutlery and hums something to himself as he sets to work. When Joe arrives, he does so with a flourish, presenting all his freshly purchased gains with pride. Niall helps put things away in the fridge and the cupboards, mystified by the myriad of spices and fresh produce Joe's gathered. I found you some hazelnuts, too, he proclaims, shaking the plastic bin in front of Nikki's face. Thank you, Nikki says, perfectly polite. He takes the bin and sets it to the side before fetching up some vegetables for a salad. Dinner will be ready in half an hour, he tells Niall. It's an easy dismissal, and she takes it for what it is. She goes to her new room, and she kicks off her shoes. She's used to living with other people. She's familiar with the way bodies move this way and that. She knows it's a simple thing at the end of the day, but she's really not at all certain about how she's meant to fit in with this group of people. With Andy, who sometimes seems desperately old, but then other times is just the same as everyone else. With Joe and Nikki, who are so familiar with each other and their interests that she can understand exactly why Booker had been appalled. Niall hadn't been there when Booker had given his assessment of their relationship, but she'd heard Booker's words paraphrased more than a few times. Joe and Nikki always had each other, and everyone else was left alone to their grief. It's a little hard to not feel that way herself. She doesn't begrudge them for their relationship, certainly, but they're so blindingly in love that it feels a bit lonesome to stand at their sides. and someday soon, Andy will be gone, and all Niall will have is them. She hears metal tapping and moving about outside, and she glances out the window to find Joe at the grill. A far less sensible part of her thinks, oh, so it's like that between them. Because she can be as progressive as she likes, but she still has an idea of enforced gender roles that feel as natural as breathing. The man grills, while the woman stays in the kitchen. She grimaces at the thought, chiding herself at the judgment. Joe whistles a little as he watches the grill. He reminds her a bit of her father as he does. All he needs is some suspenders and a bottle of beer, and he'd fit the image perfectly. Niall's heart hurts at the thought. The smell of spices and oil waft through the house. Her stomach gurgles as her mouth waters. When she's called down to eat, she's already worked herself up a bit. Man, I'm starving, she announces as she inspects the glorious spread. There's a colorful salad with proper salad spoons and some kind of unidentifiable white stringy stuff in a bowl with white dressing over it. And then, of course, the burgers themselves, each with a thick bun and perfectly melted cheese on top. Hungry, Nikki murmurs. Huh? She looks at him, and he blinks twice before looking up at her a bit sheepishly. Nothing. Sorry, he says. You're hungry, Andy says, as she settles into a chair across from her. Not starving. I mean, yeah, of course, it's just a figure of speech. Of course, Nikki smiles. Joe enters at long last, two wine bottles carefully held between his fingers and glasses held between each gap of his fingers. He serves everyone, dropping a kiss to Nikki's head before sitting across from him. They plate up their food, and Niall moans when she tastes the burger. There's a hint of spice in it that she cannot identify, but makes her desperate for more. God, Nikki, what did you do to this? It's amazing. Onion and garlic, a bit of chili, and parsley. He sounds appropriately pleased with himself. And if she knew he could make burgers like this before Booker had been sentenced, she'd have agreed much more easily to his pseudo-punishment. How dare anyone try to remove this from the world? Chili, she groans. It's such an inspired idea. She takes another bite. It's a masterclass of food. Where did you learn to cook like this? Everywhere, he laughs. She's halfway through her burger before she even looks at the rest of the food available. What's that? She points to the white, stringy things. Celery root, he replies. Do you want to try? She does. He reaches for it and offers her some, and she isn't sure if she should try to swirl it on her fork or just eat the vaguely noodle-shaped things all at once. She does the best she can and gives it a go, and it's another flavor she hadn't expected. It's like potato salad. Mustard and mayonnaise, yes, he agrees. You're a wizard. He seems very pleased to hear that. He has a very nice face, Niall thinks. It's not movie star perfect, and she thinks he could do a little better with his hair and upkeep. But when he smiles, it feels genuine. His eyes sparkle with his joy. She could understand someone wanting to be with him for 1,000 years, especially if he cooked like this. He goes back to eating his own meal, and for the first time she realizes it's far less extravagant. He's got a fair portion of his celery root magic, and some of the salad that Niall hasn't tried yet but presumes is delicious. But no burger? She asks, confused. She didn't think he was a vegetarian, but she genuinely can't recall at this point. She knows most Mediterranean families are batty about meat, though. My big fat Greek wedding had been a staple of her childhood, and even 1,000-year-old Italians must have something in common with that. Ah, he hesitates. Not today, he says simply. More for the rest of us, Joe cuts in. He takes a long sip of his wine, and then launches into a story from their past that Niall is fairly certain is entirely made up. But Nikki smiles at him like he's the most wonderful man in the world, and Andy looks so desperately fond that Niall's not about to complain. She listens, and she grins, and she feels a bit closer to them somehow, even though it all seems a bit beyond her. Joe and Nikki continue to be beautiful and perfect and right. It's everywhere she looks, everywhere she turns. They go running together. They do passive play together, Nikki reading and Joe sketching. Joe tells stories and tall tales, and Nikki listens to him with the patience of a mountain, perfectly willing to stand still for eternity and let Joe's words wash over every part of his being. Niall rounds a corner one day and finds Nikki working on some kind of bread. His hands are coated in flour, and Joe is sat up on the counter chattering away with a bowl of sliced fruit in his lap. He brings up slices to Nikki's lips, and Nikki nibbles them off his fingers while continuing his laborious task of trying to beat his dough into submission. "You make loving someone look so easy," Niall tells them. It's a warm spring day. The sun is shining strongly through their westward windows, and Niall doesn't think she's ever seen a more happy couple. Even her parents had not radiated the kind of peace that exists between them, and her parents have been desperately in love. Joe seems a little surprised at the comment. Nikki glances over his shoulder at her, but then returns to his bread bashing. "Love isn't easy," Nikki says, "but it can look that way. You guys, you make it look effortless." Joe snorts and looks down at the bowl in his hands. "To tell you the truth, Niall, for a long time I think we both wondered if we'd be better off without the other." That seems inconceivable, but Nikki doesn't correct him. He keeps rolling his dough, kneading it this way and that. "I don't believe you," Niall says. "How could either of you think that way?" "Bad beginnings," Nikki says. Joe adds on, "uncertain middles and happy endings," like he's quoting something from long ago. Nikki smiles at him, that fathomless smile that says so much, but Niall cannot decipher what. It's hard sometimes to keep track of everything that they went through. She knows the brushstrokes of their lives. She knows the facts that are given and believed. Nikki had been a crusader. Joe had been of the people he'd been taught to hate. It took them 10 years to figure themselves out. Still, the story feels unreal. All of them feel unreal. She nods slowly, accepting their opinion, but still feeling terribly off-kilter about it. She gets the drink she'd originally gone into the kitchen to obtain, then goes back to her room to play on the laptop Copley had gotten for her. She pulls up the history of the First Crusade. There is so much that she did not know. And now that she does know, there's so much she wishes she hadn't looked up in the end. Joe and Nikki are opposite ends of a magnet that should never meet. And yet, they are the same magnet, and they connect perfectly along their center point. She reads about their past, and she gets angry and frustrated and upset the more she reads. But she looks at them every day, and they are at peace at each other's sides. "Will I forget the things that define me one day?" Niall asks Andy about 6 months into their time together. They've gone to the park for a picnic. Joe and Nikki are shooting each other with water guns and running about like children with bare feet. "Yes," Andy says. "Concepts of personhood are fleeting. They evolve as we do. Who you are today is different from who you will be tomorrow." Andy doesn't sugarcoat anything. She's blunt and honest, and Niall's stomach clenches at the thought. She crosses her arms over her chest, and she chews on her bottom lip. "How did he forgive Nikki for the Crusades?" she asks. Andy reaches for the bag of pretzels that someone had prepacked. She opens it and spills a handful into her palm. "Don't talk to Nikki about it," she says first. "Talk to Joe if you want to, but don't talk to Nikki about it." "Guilty conscience?" Niall asks. "Yes," she replies. She meets Niall's eyes. Nikki has spent every single day of his life regretting what he did during that year. Give him the courtesy of respecting that. And Joe, the dignity of a choice. They didn't have to fall in love, but they did. "Was it Stockholm Syndrome?" she asks. "No," Andy replies. "No, They both made the choices they did because they both worked for the future they have. They weren't manipulated or blinded or dependent on anything. They could have walked away. If they properly hated each other, they would have. I'll tease them about how long it took them to fall in love, but only because I see this. She points to where Nikki had ducked low and shoulder-checked Joe in the stomach. He completes his tackle, and Joe abandons his water gun to wrestle with Nikki, rolling about in the mud they'd made. And I know how much they care. But Nikki became a better person. So did Joe, Andy intervenes. Joe might not have marched off to enforce his religious beliefs on another community, but he wasn't perfect. Nobody is perfect. No relationship is perfect, for that matter. They both have changed over the years. They'll continue to change, same as you, same as all of us. We're not set in stone or locked in amber. And in some ways, we are not immune to that passage of time. So we can become bad people too? Andy chews on her pretzels. She nods. You've already seen what happens if someone decides to take things to the extreme, haven't you? Booker. It's hard to watch two people who are so effortlessly in love all the time, though, Nyla admits. It's lonely. Yeah, Andy agrees. Except it's not effortless, Nyle. We just take it for granted that they manage to work it out. But I promise you, everything you see from them, that's not effortless. Not by a long shot. The team goes out on their first mission together, and Joe tells a story of the first time Andy, Quinn, Nikki, and he went hunting. They're all on a chopper about ready to get dropped into hostile territory to take out the heads of three different black market arms operations at the same time. Joe ignores all of that and tells them of a competition that broke out between the girls and the boys, each needing to prove themselves to the other. Nyle is in near tears. She laughs so hard through most of the story. Andy has offered her own opinions and embellishments. Nikki has just smiled and nodded, shaking his head but not trying to correct a thing. He is, Nyle considers, immeasurably indulgent of his husband. He looks at Joe with the expression of a man who has seen all there is the world has to offer and found it all lacking in the comparison to all that is Joe. They are not a particularly effusive couple. They embrace, and they kiss, and they say all the charming things couples say, darling, dear, love, but they are not ignorant of their passion. There haven't been any sock-on-the-doorknob moments that Nyle can think of, and despite an obvious closeness between them, they have never once been overtly sexual in her presence. No, their commitment is more vividly cerebral than that. It's a current in the air, that magnetism. Joe tells his tall tales, and it doesn't matter that he tells them to Nyle and Andy as well. It doesn't matter that his eyes are almost always fixated on Nyle and her reactions. His eyes glance towards Nikki intermittently, and his expression shifts in reaction to whatever he sees there. He grins, and he winks, and he embellishes, all for Nikki. Nikki isn't just Joe's lover and life partner. He is Joe's best friend. Marry your best friend, Nyle's mama used to say. Marry the person you want to tell all your happy news to first. The one you think of when you need to scream at the world. The one who will hold your hand when you're happy and when you're sad. That's the person you really want to spend the rest of your life with. It's what she sees in them. It takes her breath away. Every time. Their first proper mission together is a success. They celebrate with pizza. They put on music loud and dance together as Andy laughs and throws napkins at them. Nyle is spun from one hand to the next. Nikki apparently knows how to Lindy Hop very well, and he teaches her a few swing steps as Parav Sterer comes on the playlist. How do you have such good taste in music? She asks. No old people have good taste in music. It is easy enough to look up what's popular, he suggests, even as Joe and Andy both voice their protests at her assessment. Whoa, whoa, that's uncalled for, ageist. Just because it's easy doesn't mean you did. This is a custom playlist. She holds up his smartphone to get her point across. He smiles, like she said something particularly amusing. Oh, God. Andy shoves a huge bite of pizza in her mouth. What was it? 80s? 90s? When you had one of those recorder things. You and Book spent like 10 hours a day waiting for the radio to come on so you could hit play at the exact right moment to get your song saved just right. Niall's mouth drops a little at the image. Nikki flushes, but Joe's cutting in too. And the words you used whenever the DJ decided to talk in the tail end of the song or transition mid-beat. Legend has spoken of people like you, Niall tells Nikki gamefully. He looks surprised. What? It was only 30 years ago. There cannot be legends. There are, she holds up a closed fist. Mad respect, bro. You want to see something cool, Niall? And then Andy and Joe are pulling her over to the cupboard under the big flat-screen TV. There are two rows of very thin strips of cardboard lined from one end of the cupboard to the other. Joe pulls one out at random, and it's a vinyl record. Is that an original? She blurts out. Yeah, Nikki went through a phase. Andy is absolutely teasing him about it. She's grinning in Nikki's direction, and Niall hears him grumble under his breath. Niall crosses her legs and pulls out albums one by one, reading their titles. Some of them are beyond rare. He has all the big-name rock groups of the 60s, but it's more than that. There's blues and jazz and big swing. There's Edith Piaf, Peppino, Gagliardi, Aaron Copland, and Sergei Rachmaninoff. He even has some Broadway records mixed in. You really like music, don't you? It's wonderful, Nikki agrees. I'm happy to have heard how it evolved. They all end up on the floor. There's a record player in another part of the cupboard that Joe pulls out without comment. He hooks it up, and it's obviously far more modern than the records are, but Nikki seems to know exactly what he's doing. They all do. Andy pulls out one record that doesn't have any recognizable name on it. Joe gets out another. These were written about 100 years after I was born, Nikki explains, as the sound of female voices harmonize together. But they are similar to things that I listened to in the Abbey. 100 years after you? Yes, he frowns and looks to Joe. They were written by Hildegard von Bingen, he explains. She was actually born the year before we died, 1098. He nudges Nikki's arm with his. The shit you two remember, Andy shakes her head, far too fond. Switch it up, Nikki. There's something a little pointed in the request, and he does. He removes the record and passes it with the one Joe's holding. This is 12th century, Nikki says. He puts on the next record and moves the needle to a spot he clearly memorized a long time before. Adir lana aquab, he says, words flowing smooth as silk off his tongue. The record starts to spin, and it's entirely different. Faster, with a drum and a rattle and some sort of stringed instrument, intoning higher notes as multiple voices sing the lyrics in unison. Joe hands her the record sleeve, and she flips it over to read the words on the back. There's a set of translated lyrics there. Adir lana aquab, pass to us the cups, with which sorrow is forgotten, and summon our companions, since love is at an end. Obey the law of love as long as you live, my friend, and turn your ear from the words of the reviler. You are ordered to hasten. Here is your wine. Fingertips stained red with jujube, and your red sweetmeat mouth are enveloped in myrtle, dark tresses, which the cheek coils. Pass to us the cups with which sorrow is forgotten. Would you dance to this? She asks, and Joe purses his lips, considering, before grinning wide. He says something in a language Niall doesn't understand, and Nikki rolls his eyes before letting Joe pull him to his feet and quickly out of the room. Andy, we're borrowing your clothes, Joe calls over his shoulder. The album keeps playing without them, changing songs to something a little smoother, but no less pleasant to the ear. "What did he mean?" she asked once the door to Joe and Nikki's bedroom had closed. "Just what he said, you'll see." She sounds so fond of them. She always does. Niall leans against Nikki's cupboard of records, and it feels like leaning against Copley's stalker wall. There's a whole history in there, a whole world that's evolved from literally the moment Joe and Nikki died to this, Hildegard von Bingen, to Parav Sterer. "So if it took them 10 years to become them," Niall asks, "how long did it take for you to..." She's not sure how she wants to phrase it. "Love them too." She doesn't mean intimately, but there's no other way to really say what she means. Andy seems to understand. She snatches up a bit of garlic bread and eats it in small bites. "I loved them from the start," Andy admits. Then she winks at Niall. "You too, you know. Love at first stabbing. It's a bit of a tradition, really. Even Booker got in a few good hits." "Maybe you just have one of those faces," Niall tells her. Andy laughs. "Maybe." She's still turned toward the door. "Watching those first few years, they struggled a lot. Quinn and I, we knew what they were going through, what they were trying to come to terms with, but we were in Far East Asia at the time. It's a lot easier nowadays to find people than it was back then. We got faster at it as time went on, of course, but getting you in less than 48 hours was a new one for us." "Does it make a lot of difference in the end?" No one explained what was happening. "You didn't really either. At least you knew you weren't alone. For them, considering everything. Niccolo thought he was cursed by his god, and Yusuf swung from it being a punishment to a boon. Once we had a chance to talk to them, it helped ease some of their confusion. But I think all us being together in general was just better for that, too. Once they realized they weren't alone, that it isn't some god's will or divine punishment, it gave room for all this love." She laughs somewhat. "Those two. It's been kind of their thing from the start, finding all things that are good and cherishing that which makes them happy." She gestures to the albums. "Yusuf started painting and sculpting. Niccolo started into music and cooking. He really wanted to make good food." Joe and Nikki's door opens, and they come bumbling out into the hall. Niall blinks up and laughs loudly. They're wearing bathrobes over what look like very long skirts. They're grinning at each other, and Andy scowls as they approach, arms crossed over their chests. She's eyeing up their skirts as if measuring just how the two managed to pull them on. Niall can't even imagine Andy owning them in the first place, but clearly she should have had more faith in Joe and Nikki's ability to memorize Andy's wardrobe. Both bow a little, and Andy sighs and stands up. She bows her head in turn, and Niall wonders if she should be doing something else, but then Joe's pulling off his bathrobe and she laughs again. He's taken off his t-shirt from earlier and is now wearing a very small silk vest that barely manages to squeeze around the breadth of his shoulders. "You're going to ruin those," Andy complains, without much heat. She bows to Nikki when he bows to her and reveals the same vest situation as Joe. "Hush," Joe chastises. "It's your fault that you're built like a twig, and we didn't have anything else here. You didn't need the skirts to begin with." "It's part of the charm," Nikki replies. He masterfully plucks up his hem as he bends down towards the record player and resets the needle to the right track. Then he stands up and moves a little further back. When the music starts, it's unlike any dance Niall has ever seen. They're standing far enough apart that they can't touch, even when they hold their arms outstretched. They turn their right palms up, left ones down. Their right hand is ever so slightly more elevated than the other. Then they start to turn. It's slow at first, but increases speed over time. The hems of their skirts raise and whoosh out in rippling waves, like the ocean rising and falling in time with their steps. They keep one foot steady and stable on the ground, The other serves as a balance. Andy shuffles a little so she can whisper in her ear. It's called a few things, Andy tells her. The whirling dervish, or Sufi whirling, is most common. Usually they wear hats, too. Those come off the head like this. She mimes a figure that Niall imagines a bit like a fez, only taller. They're made out of camel hair and are called sikas. Niall keeps waiting for another step of the dance, but they haven't changed anything. They just keep spinning, over and over again, hands rising up with their heads tilted ever so slightly back and over in the direction of the turn. It's an endless pirouette. The sika is meant to symbolize a tombstone of the ego, and their skirts, their tunure, should be white. That's meant to be a shroud of the ego. The robes, well, that's a bit of an attempt, but usually the dervish starts with a black cloak, or hurka, over their white shroud. When they take it off, they're supposed to be spiritually reborn. They keep spinning. Niall doesn't know how they aren't getting dizzy. Surely if this is a proper dance, then normal people can do it too. But all she can think of is that time her brother spun her about in a rolly chair until she got sick from it. Neither Joe nor Nikki looked the least bit sick. How are they doing it? She whispers. Andy points. So the right hand is aimed up at the sky. That's for God's gifts or offerings. Praise isn't quite right, but neither is favor. More like his acceptance that you're a decent person and his willingness for you to do well. It's the left one that actually matters. Niall stares at Nikki's left hand. It takes her a moment, but then she realizes he's staring at his left hand, too. Something about the left hand receiving from the body the gifts of the right and being a symbol together of God's love of earth. What's more important is that it keeps them from wobbling and falling face first into the nearest wall. The song ends, and when it does, Joe and Nikki slowly come to a stop. Niall waits very patiently for them to tumble. They do not. It's also, Andy continues, with the keen voice of authority on the matters, absolutely not dance to this song. They just wanted to show off. Joe sticks his tongue out at her. What did you think? He asks Niall instead. I've never seen anything like it, she admits. It's still performed in Turkey, Nikki tells her. We should take you sometime. It is more nice with a bigger stage and more people. He's fumbled a bit on his English there, but it's somehow endearing. It's called Sufi whirling. Are either of you Sufi? Ah, no, not really, Joe shrugs. He rubs the back of his head. But he glances at Nikki, who is very carefully trying to remove Andy's vest and realizing it's a little bit stuck on his upper arms. Andy groans loudly and stands up to help him, muttering at him the whole time. We like the message. We've liked the message since the 12th century. And our religion, our faith, it's changed a bit with us. Some things stay the same. Some things are different. And this felt right for us. Niall's stomach clenches a bit. She doesn't understand the enormity of Joe's comment. She can feel the weight and strength of it. She can see the broad strokes of a paintbrush that shape the contours of his life thus far. But it feels like too much. It feels like something no human mind should comprehend. To form a religious ideal or purpose seems beyond that of normal men. And while she knows they are not properly normal, it all still feels far too beyond them. She tries to imagine them more than 700 years ago, learning a dance meant to symbolize rebirth and new life. She imagines them spinning endlessly on the swirling waters of the sea, washing up onto the sands of time. It feels like far too much to comprehend, far too much to believe. Nikki finally gets out of Andy's vest and he meets her eyes. Would you like to learn? He asks her. Slowly, hesitantly, she nods and gets to her feet. He offers her his hand, and she takes it. It feels like leaping off a cliff and having faith that everything will be all right in the end. It feels like falling and not knowing when she'll hit the bottom. 7 missions in, Niall and Nikki get captured. It's less of a Merrick-style kidnapping situation and more of a relocation to another part of the building they'd already been infiltrating. Niall's earpiece is still tucked into position just behind her ear. Her hair covers it mostly. Copley had wanted to try out a new system, where the system attaches at the base of the earlobe and threads along the hairline and under her clothes, rather than the usual ear insert. It works because it isn't immediately removed the second they get caught. Nikki's is. She can hear Joe's calm voice telling her what she needs to do while she's being dragged down a too long hallway to a room that seems artistically inappropriate for an interrogation. It isn't dark or creepy or scary. There's no menacing filing cabinet or flickering light. It is a perfectly respectable sitting room, with a table seemingly primed for the next morning's tea service. The carpet looks fancy and expensive. She's tossed onto an honest-to-God sofa that is frustratingly comfortable, considering the fact she's meant to be scared right now. And she is scared. She'd be insane not to be scared. She's horrifically frightened about what's going to happen. In the Marines, they tell you what to do if you're taken prisoner. Name, serial number, and memorized regulations regarding legal rights afforded to prisoners of war. She can't give her name, and she no longer has a serial number. She's not a prisoner of war. She's some sex trafficker's captive. Niall looks across from her to Nikki, who has not been given a nice, comfortable sofa to sit on, but instead a large wingback armchair. He looks a little ridiculous in that chair, with his hands bound and tack gear clashing with the floral print of the upholstery. The goons keep their guns trained on Nikki and Niall at all times, and Niall wishes she'd had the foresight to let them kill her rather than take her hostage. They'd have let their guard down around a dead body. Now there's plenty of people aiming their guns right at them, and Niall feels a little queasy at the thought of what the next few hours might bring. From the first moment they'd been caught, Joe and Andy had been speaking, plotting. The goons think that they have come alone, and that no one else is in the compound. Nikki and Niall are effectively one great big distraction, and the rest of their team can't mount an immediate rescue until they get their part of the mission taken care of, their part being the freeing of human cargo preparing to be shipped off to parts unknown. Between two people who will come back from the dead, if it gets that far, and the literal victims being held in cages, Niall knows who takes priority here. She accepts it and wants it that way, in truth. That doesn't make their circumstances any better. It takes some time before the office door opens, and the man of the hour, Lorenzo Tucco, strolls in. He is dressed in a beautiful silk shirt and custom suit that looks divine on him. If he wasn't an actual sexual predator with a taste for burning his property with a brand bearing his symbol, she could even see him as somewhat appealing. She'd lost any time of appreciation for his physique the moment she saw his handiwork, though. Now she looks at him and only feels a deep sense of loathing. "I'm on a schedule," Lorenzo says. Then Nikki's talking to him in Italian, and Niall understands very little of what happens next. She's been practicing the language. Nikki has been spending a few hours a week teaching her all the different types of words, pronouns, nouns, adjectives, familiar and formal. But their language training had been simple at best. She can ask for directions and work out the recipe for dinner. She's rather certain Nikki isn't offering to teach Lorenzo how to make arroz con pollo. Lorenzo's nostrils flare at one point. He pulls a gun from his waistband, holds it by the barrel, and snaps it across Nikki's face. The stock smashes brutally across Nikki's cheek. Its head snaps to one side. She hisses at the sight. Nikki takes a second, keeping his head down. Part of it, she thinks, must come from a need to catch his breath. But the other part, that type of hit had to have left a mark. When Nikki lifts his head, it's already healed. No puffing, no bruising, no sign of trauma. He says something else, taunting the man. He grins. Niall does understand one word. Nikki had used it to describe flavoring. Weak, Nikki calls Lorenzo now. Niall's fingers curl in her lap. She shakes her head, desperate to get Nikki to just shut up. "Niall," Andy's voice cuts into her ear. Niall, listen to me. He knows what he's doing. Nikki keeps talking, and Lorenzo shouts back. Lorenzo snaps his fingers, and his goons are snatching Nikki by the arms. He's getting pulled up, then thrown down on his knees. His arms are secured tight behind his back, and he's held in place as Lorenzo wraps his fingers around Nikki's hair and jerks him about roughly. Lorenzo looks at Niall then. Someone's hands pin her shoulders against the couch. Nikki laughs. He grins, lips spreading and teeth showing. In English, he says, perfectly clear, "No, I wouldn't." Lorenzo glances his way. Nikki doesn't even seem to notice. His eyes meet hers, and he very firmly, very clearly instructs. He says, "She bites." And Niall's heart sinks through her stomach and departs from her body. Lorenzo posits an almost inquiring, "Et tu?" She knows that. "And you?" He strokes Nikki's hair a little before pulling it taut. The hands on Niall's shoulders become more firm, as if expecting her to try to intervene. She shakes her head. "Mordo a meno." Nikki replies, "Less, something less." The O is for the IO form, so I something less. "Bite?" Niall shakes her head again. Her lips part, but Nikki glares at her past Lorenzo's body. She's never seen his face look so fierce before. She's never seen him look so purely enraged by anything more than the mere thought of her trying to interfere in whatever horror is about to play out before them. "Girls are out," Joe's voice says in Niall's ear. Her hands curl into fists. Unless they're right on the opposite side of the door, nothing is going to stop this from happening in time. Nikki's earpiece isn't in place. He doesn't know that he needs to stall, not egg them on. But then Nikki murmurs something. His expression slips back from hateful and angry into something Niall can only describe as inquisitive. He murmurs it, and even Lorenzo seems to not hear him properly. He leans in close, too close. One moment, Nikki is whispering soft words right into Lorenzo's ear, and the next, his teeth are latching soundly around Lorenzo's throat. He's biting and tearing. Niall can't help her own scream of horror that is echoed by every one of Lorenzo's goons. Nikki is hauled backwards. Lorenzo collapses to the ground. He's choking on blood. Nikki is moving. The guard's attention is on their boss. Nikki rolls over his own shoulder, arms somehow ending back in front of his body before he propels himself to his feet. He breaks one man's neck and is turning to the other when Niall thinks to move as well. She throws her hands back, grabs the clothing of the man behind her, and throws with all her might. He goes sailing and Niall charges. She shoves her shoulder into the man's falling body. Her hands snap to his gun and she yanks it free. One shot to his head. Two more on the ones that Nikki has already dealt with. She whirls about and finds Nikki killing the last of the men who were meant to keep them secure. All that's left is Lorenzo. Lorenzo, who is clutching the gaping hole in his neck, gurgling through blood that bubbles up from his lungs, badly oxygenated and foaming. She aims the gun and kills him in one shot. "Niall?" Joe asks. "We got it," she tells him. We're good. We'll meet you outside." A slight pause, then Andy's saying, "Copy." Niall looks at Nikki, his back's to her. She hears him spit, sees him wiping the back of his hand across his face. When he turns to face her, there's no hiding the gore, but he smiles anyway. "Are you all right?" "Fine." She doesn't mean to snap. She can't help it. He's standing there looking like a horror film reject for the second time in a year, and he's smiling at her. He blinks a bit quickly, as if he has the moral high ground to be appalled at her reaction. But his smile only becomes slightly more fond, a little more gentle. He parts his lips to speak. She interrupts. "We need to meet the others outside." "Oh, of course." She walks past him and he follows. They walk briskly through the compound. Every time a lingering member of Lorenzo's crew meanders into the line of fire, Niall takes them down. Quick, brutal efficiency. They barely had time to notice or care. She's sickeningly grateful in a way, because she needs this. She needs something to shoot and hit and destroy, because if she has to think about what just happened, she's not sure what she'll do. There aren't enough people, though. And when they step outside, the entire compound has gone silent. The truck with their survivors in it seems to have already pulled out. Copley had arranged for someone to manage the transport of the victims so that they could worry about cleanup and disappearing. It means that it's only Andy and Joe waiting for them, back at their own escape car. Both of them turn on a dime when Niall steps into view. Their relief is obvious at first, but then they see Nikki. "Fucking hell, what happened?" Andy asks when she sees them, which is the exact appropriate response to all of this. "I'm fine," Nikki says, which is the exact wrong response to all of this. "He bit someone's throat out," Niall says, trying not to feel like a tattler in school. Joe and Andy look at her, then back at Nikki. "I'm fine," Nikki repeats. "Do you have something I can..." Andy tosses him a water bottle without comment. Nikki catches it, pours some of it out on his hand, and starts washing his face. Joe opens the car door. He ducks inside and then comes out with a first aid kit that seems laughably useless for people like them. He opens the kit and finds some wet wipes. Then he's murmuring something to Nikki, and Nikki uses the water to swish and spit now instead. Joe gets the rest of the gore from his lips and chin. Shit, there's even some blood that had gotten up on his eyelids. Niall's stomach clenches as she turns away. "Niall, sit up front with me on the drive back," Andy requests. Niall's almost glad for it. She's not sure she knows what to say about Nikki right now. She's not sure how you tell someone that they're terrifying when they're simultaneously the nicest person she's ever met. Maybe time really doesn't change much. They bundle into the car, and the ride back to their safe house is a mostly quiet affair. Nikki rests his head on Joe's chest, and Joe has an arm around his shoulders, and they look like they've fallen asleep for the most part. Niall keeps glancing back at them, and she can't help the feeling that something is incredibly wrong. Even when the car stops, it all feels a bit unreal. Nikki's eyes flutter open. He catches her staring, and he smiles at her indulgently. "Are you all right?" he asks. "Fine," she says. Joe takes Nikki by the hand, and they disappear behind the solid frame of their bedroom door. She is not fine. "Niall," Andy speaks like she wants to say more, but then she doesn't. Her lips press into a thin line, and Niall turns to face her fully. She waits, impatient for more, and Andy eventually gives in, sighs. "You're upset about how he handled the situation." "It's a bit fucked up," Niall says. Andy nods. "You didn't understand what they were saying, did you?" It occurs to her that Joe and Andy had heard what was happening in that room, that they could hear it through her earpiece and had been unable to do anything except listen, offer reassurances, and try to work faster to get the survivors to safety. She's not sure what she would have done in such a situation. She's not sure she has the capacity to be that unaffected, to have just stood at the car and waited after Niall gave the all clear. Not for the first time, she's a bit horrified by the extremes that their team will go to. She had killed one person before Merrick's lab, one person only, and then afterwards, the amounts were endless. She doesn't recognize the person she's becoming. She doesn't recognize the burning sensation within her that's angry and furious and wants to lash out at all the world around her. But that fledgling feeling still feels raw and unformed, a sensation defined by its infancy. She's not so wholly gone that she cannot tell the difference between rational and irrational, human and animal. "He tore his throat out with his teeth," Niall hisses. Andy's eyes flick back to the bedroom door, still firmly closed. Niall's fingers clench tight. She imagines Joe and Nikki kissing, cuddling, spooning up next to each other, making love like they often do, and all of it just being another post-mission success story, never to be considered again. He didn't do it lightly, Andy tells her. Do you know how fucked up that is? Really? Niall asks. Or is this just another goalpost? I'll get used to it. That's just the way things are. In a few years, I'll be doing the same. No, Andy shakes her head. No, it's different. And it's not the norm. It happens, she admits that easily. But it isn't something that happens often or with great intent. Oh, it happens, Niall seethes. Yeah, Niall, Andy murmurs. It happens, but I don't want to hear it. She turns toward the bathroom. She needs a shower and 20 years of sleep. She gets one of those things at least. It's impossible to avoid people in this family. She knows that. They live on top of each other too much for that. Still, Niall takes her time in emerging from her room the next day. She goes through all of her morning routines that she can manage without actually entering the communal areas. She takes another shower. She brushes her teeth. She gets dressed. She looks at herself in the mirror and tries to feel calm enough to at least be polite. The night had helped take some of the shock off. It had soothed some of her apocalyptic anger and fears of becoming just like that one day. But her brain keeps circling back to the image of Nikki's face coated in blood, smiling at her, and asking if she's all right. The duality is too difficult to explain, and it is impossible to ignore. She leaves her room eventually. She slinks down the hall, and she finds Joe washing dishes at the sink. No Nikki or Andy. Hey, she calls out. Joe leans his head back and then gives her a weird kind of backwards head tilt in an attempt at a greeting. Hey, he says. Didn't know when you'd wake up. There's coffee. Want me to get you something else? There's still leftover bread from yesterday, and jam, too. She replies in the negative and starts fixing herself breakfast as Joe turns off the tap and sets out drying plates and returning them to their shelves. Where are the others? She asks. Now that she's listening for it, she doesn't hear anyone moving about. Went for a walk, he replies. Gives me time to ambush you. Niall's fingers tighten around her bread knife. She scowls as she slices off strips of bread and sets them on her plate. Andy must have told him about her reaction the night before. Andy can be a terrible gossip at times. She has no concept of privacy or keeping things between themselves. She tells her boys everything. I'll get over it, Niall mutters. She doesn't want to look at him. He's finished cleaning up, and she can almost imagine him leaning against the counter with his arms crossed and his head tilted, waiting for her to actually try to participate. He may look old enough to be her brother, but sometimes it's blatantly clear that he's far older than that. He has the disappointed dad energy down pat. You will, he agrees simply. It sets her teeth on edge. Her fist slams on the counter, and she whirls around. He is standing exactly as she imagined him to be. His expression is only just a touch more condescending than she'd thought up. Is it really that fucking easy, she asks, to do things like that? No, he says. It's not easy at all. They were going to rape you, Niall. Either you or him or both, it didn't matter who, but they were going to do it. I worked that out for myself, thanks. Would you have preferred it happen, then? Joe's head tilts a little. Next time you're in a situation like that, would you have preferred it gone that way? Nikki just sitting there, watching while they did what they wanted to you, not because they needed you to admit to anything, just because they could. He asks it like it'll actually make a difference, as if the answer she gives now will go into the team response guide on how to address situations as they arise, chapter 6, page 24, subsection R. In the event of potential assault, do not bite the throat of captor and allow Niall to be raped. I heard him warning you, Joe says. So he wanted you to do the same. It's not the same.
Oh?
If they tried that, it's not the same. It's different. So he should have waited until Tuco had actually put his dick in his mouth to tear it off? That's better than biting Tuco's throat. That's what you'd prefer? Niall shakes her head. She throws her hand up in the air and brings it down hard. I'd prefer some sort of acknowledgement from anybody that it's a bit fucking extreme. Of course it was, Joe says. He doesn't sound any more shocked about it than Andy had. Of course it is, he amends. But it was also an extreme situation. Nikki doesn't just go around biting people for the fun of it. Isn't that just what they did back in his day? Niall asks. It was as if she struck him in the face with a shovel. For a moment, he looks so completely bewildered that she isn't sure he really understood what she was implying. Then his arms uncrossed. The skin under his right eye twitched as his lips twisted into a snarl. Even when he'd been furious with Booker, he'd never looked so viciously angry before. The Crusades, he clarifies. It feels like the oxygen is being sucked from the room. Her back straightens. Her chin tilts up. She will not be bullied or cowed into submission. She spent too long living in Chicago and training as a Marine to care when an angry man approached her. You're talking about the Crusades. Yeah, she says. I know what you read, he spits out. I was actually there, so let me give you some first-hand perspective. It wasn't a matter of, let's go on crusade and eat people, like a village of Hannibal Lecter wannabes desperate for a good time. It came about because they were starving to the point of insanity. He takes a step towards her. That year tortured him for every year that has passed since. You do not get to judge him for something that happened 1,000 years ago. It was my people. My creed. My life. I get to make that choice, not you. Another step. They're nearly toe to toe. And just in case it wasn't absolutely fucking obvious, he didn't attack Lorenzo Tuco because he was suddenly overwhelmed by the need to eat a man. He did it to create an opening that kept you from getting hurt. How did you forgive him? Niall asks. How could you possibly forgive him for doing what he did? And it's as if all of Joe's momentum has been left to crash violently to the earth. His shoulders slump, and between one breath and the next, Niall feels like she can breathe again. His wrath is gone, replaced by something far more complicated than all that. Niall, it took us over 10 years to find our place at each other's side. I forgave him because he had spent every moment of his immortality since his first revived breath feeling guilty about what he did on crusade. I forgave him because I believed him, because I saw and understood the trauma he was facing, and he saw and understood my own. I have not once regretted spending my life with him. I never will. He massacred your people. Yes. And in the years after he learned the language and culture of those people, he escorted travelers safely home. He cared for orphans in need of protection. And he did battle with his own countrymen who continued to attack or harass the people of Syria. He learned medicine and began treating the sick. He fought to restore land to those who had it stolen from them. He worked to make it better, to do good. Joe shakes his head. You cannot hold someone accountable for the actions they did on the worst days of their life, but then ignore all the good they did for the rest of it. He's lived almost 1,000 years. Are you truly going to judge him solely on the deeds he committed during one? You gave Booker 100 years of solitude for the deeds he committed during just one. Slowly, Joe steps back. He steps back and puts some space between them again. He rests his hands on the counter and he looks out the window above the kitchen sink. Nikki couldn't eat properly for our first 20 years, he says. It feels like a non sequitur. She frowns, nose scrunching as she tries to understand. For the first 7, he didn't eat at all. He starved himself in penance, calling it fasting, and let himself die over and over again in an attempt to appease God. After it became easier between us, he started eating better, but only to a point. He had years of setbacks where the mere thought or smell of food would have him recoiling. He cuts a glance to her from the corner of his eye. There are whole months or years where he won't eat meat because the thought or feeling of it is too much. He grins a little. It's more of a snarl. He's in that cycle now, by the way. He has been since Merrick's. Nikki is subtle. He's quiet. He makes them elaborate meals and has catered to all her requests for one thing or another. During burger night, he'd made something so mouth-wateringly delicious and stayed eating his salads instead. He doesn't like things in his mouth, Joe continues. Anything. At this, he sends her a very pointed look. He had a choice. He could get rid of Tuco before it reached that far, or he could wait until Tuco tried to fuck him. And he would have done it, Niall. Don't doubt that for a moment. He'd have bitten Tuco's cock right off him, but then it'd have been in his mouth, and he didn't want that. He has never wanted that. It is simultaneously too much information and too little at the same time. She stares at Joe, and Joe stares unflinchingly back. He is not ashamed, nor embarrassed, nor even slightly uncertain about the words he said. He meets her eyes, and she feels a rush of confused and inappropriate questions spiraling about and crashing violently against all of the other questions she wants the answer to. At Merrick's, she managed to get out before her words fail. Keen put the gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger, Joe reiterated. He woke up to the taste of blood and the smell of smoke, and he hasn't shaken it off yet because it's a trauma he's going to be haunted by until the day he finally dies. And I get to spend the next however long it takes for Nikki to start feeling a bit better about that. At the same time, we both need to deal with the fact that our brother sold us to Merrick because he wanted to die. Booker gets 100 years, or however long it takes, for us to get over that. And frankly, that's still not blaming someone for eternity and never giving them a chance to do better. There's so much going on. Too much, really. It's Merrick and Lorenzo Tuco and Nikki and Booker and just too much violence all in one. It's immortality and trying to come to terms with what that means. It's philosophical quandaries that have no proper answer. It's too much. It's too much to think about. Too much by half. Joe doesn't try to close the gap between them. He stays by the sink, and she stays by her little plate of bread that still needs its jam. Nikki loves you, he tells her. It feels like another hit that she doesn't want to experience. He loves you, and he did what he did to save you from something he feared would traumatize you worse. He smiled, Niall whispers. Yeah, Joe says. He didn't want you to worry about him. It scared me, she wants to say. She doesn't say it. Instead, she asks, is he okay? Andy and Joe had known his backstory. He'd insisted multiple times he was fine the night before. They were worried he'd be messed up from it, and Nikki had sworn all was well. Joe shrugs one shoulder up. We'll see. Sometimes he bounces back faster than expected, but he was already in a low before this because of Merrick and Keen and... It's okay to be messed up by all this, Joe says. I promise we all have things that we don't like and can't tolerate. Is this my life? She asks. Am I just going to get traumatized over and over for the rest of my life? Because that's what we do. You're going to get hurt a lot more, he says quietly. but you're also going to have all the benefits of everything else to go along with it. What benefits? I haven't seen a single fucking benefit from the start. Time, Niall. The benefit is time itself. You have time to go to every museum in the world. You have time to go to school and study anything you want to study just to learn it. You have time to listen to every bit of music you could ever ask for. You can see the moment when the world changes. Yes, when the bad things happen and the walls go up, but you'll also be there when the walls come down. You'll be there when new technologies are made. You'll be there when things you only ever dreamed about become a reality. You have time to climb that mountain or dive into the ocean. You have time to make the worst mistakes of your life. But in 1,000 years or so, someone might come around and show you a wall that lists the effects of every good thing you ever did and how you changed the world as a result. All that came about because of time. Joe has an artist's soul. Booker had told her that when they first met. He and Andy had teased Nikki and Joe for their kind of hopeless romantic way of looking at the world. She feels like she's been caught somewhere in the middle. Joe and Nikki on one side, filled with talk of destiny and forgiveness and beauty. With Booker and Andy on the other, struggling to find the good in the world and wondering if they're enough. Andy's less depressing about it now, that she's mortal, but it still feels like Niall's trapped between extremes. You have time, too, to heal. Joe's voice drops low. It turns gentle, soft. To come to terms with this life and what it means to you. To find your own path if it's different from ours. Andy says we don't ever stay the same. She's right. You're at the beginning of a very long life, Niall. You're not the same person you were when you were an infant. You will not be the same person you are now in another 24 years or 1,000. You're going to change. So will we. The endlessness of time is terrifying in its own right. She shivers a little as the thought seems to chill her very bones. She reaches for the jam jar and a small knife to spread it with. Andy told me not to talk to Nikki about the Crusades. No, best not. She said if I had questions, I should ask you. He hums a little in agreement. We all have things we don't want to talk about or dwell over. What's the word? Triggers that make us feel more one way versus another. Nikki and the Crusades, putting things in his mouth, the smell of certain meat, those are his. And you? He huffs. When she looks at him, he manages a weak smile. As it turns out, I don't do well in isolation. I got lost in a cave system once. Took me 6 months to find my way out. Niall's hand drops. She stares at him, dumbfounded. Had a thing about being alone in the dark ever since. Never much liked being left alone to begin with, but after... He shrugs valiantly. Andy hates all things Christian. Sorry. He points to her cross. I figured that one out already, Niall says. Andy's disdain had been relatively obvious on the plane. In retrospect, she's surprised Andy put up with the Hildegard record for as long as she had. She's always been like that? No, just since Quinn. She and Nikki got into it a few times right after it happened. She's more extroverted in the things that set her off, though. She'd rather fight someone than fight herself, and so she can get mean as a snake if she gets pushed enough into it. If she hates Christianity so much, why is the Goosenville safe house a literal church? Joe laughs then, a real improper one that seems to take out the lingering tension in the room. He smiles just as kind and fond and gentle as he had the first time they met. He asks her, "Have you seen what she's done to that place?" And she finds herself smiling too. It hasn't fixed everything. She still feels an overwhelming sense of uncertainty around the idea of whatever Nikki is on about. But like everything so far, it's given her another perspective at least. The door opens after Niall finishes jamming up her bread. She takes a bite and listens as Andy and Nikki come back inside. They've gone shopping, it seems, for clothes and various other amenities. Andy schlepped all her bags onto Nikki, who looks like an old 90s boyfriend from a TV show, carrying all his girls' things home from the mall. "Andy, what did you do?" Joe whines as he crosses the room to help Nikki with the bags. He presses his lips to Nikki's cheek, and Nikki tilts his head into it, smiling a little as one of his arms is freed from its burden. Eventually, he spots her by the counter, and that smile is turned on her instead. "Hello, Niall," he says, adjusting his hold on his other arm's bags. "Did you sleep well?"
"Yes, thank you. I'm glad."
He really does seem glad, too. She tries to imagine the thing that she hates experiencing the most in the world, and then going through with it just to keep someone she's only known for a few months safe. She can't. "Do you need help?" she asks him. He offers her his arm, and she sets her bread down to take a few bags from him. "Some of this is for you, I think. I don't remember where things went. They got jumbled."
"For me?"
"We thought maybe you would like something more personal here." Joe is peeking through things, snooping about like a kid at Christmas. Nikki bats him away, shooing him easily with his fingers. He tilts the rim of some of the bags about until he says, "Ah!" and removes his find. It's not what she's expecting. She'd thought they'd gone clothing shopping, but these are flat square panels that he hands over easily. Vinyls. He got her vinyls of Frank Ocean, L. King, and Flotilla.
"Are they right?" he asks her.
She looks up at him. Yeah, they're right. He seems shy suddenly. He bit a man's throat out yesterday, but he's shy about giving her vinyls.
"I worried you might think it's not personal because of the others."
"The other records?" she clarifies, trying to understand.
"Yes, but I thought you seemed to like them when we listened to them. So you should have yours, too, for if you want to listen to those next time."
Yeah, I would." She cradles the vinyls to her chest, meets his eyes. His shoulders relax ever so slightly. His posture straightens. He's pleased. No, relieved. Joe says something about needing to show Andy something, and then they politely disappear from the kitchen without so much as glaring at her in subtle warning, trusting for some reason that she isn't going to make the rising friction between her and Nikki even worse.
"It's not your fault," she blurts out.
He tilts his head a little, like he doesn't understand. Maybe he doesn't. She started at the end. She can't bear to start from the beginning. Maybe the middle is the best place to go, all wrapped with its awkward uncertainty and hope.
"I was scared. I am scared. All of this is so new, and you..."
"I don't understand how you can just be so calm."
"Oh," Nikki murmurs, "do I seem calm?"
She stares at him. All her anxious words have run dry. He presses his fingers to his lips, contemplating.
"I don't feel calm," he tells her. "I'm scared, too."
"What are you scared of?" He didn't scream or yell or rage. He didn't curse or raise his voice. He didn't get angry or lash out. Even in that room with Tuco, he had been passive and polite. One sharply worded warning and then an explosion of movement that is still too violent to properly consider. His long lashes flutter a little above his eyes. He lowers his hands from his lips, as if it takes a great deal of effort to do so.
"Many things," Nikki says. "Many things scare me. Some more often than others."
It's vague and unhelpful. She feels like a door is closing between them, distance being made. But then,
"I'm afraid you will be hurt. I threw myself out of a building the day after I met you. Yes, Nikki says. I can take care of myself. You are very brave, Nikki says. It doesn't quite sound like a compliment as she scowls at him. He winces. I do not mean to insult. That is not, he sighs. I wanted for you the things I did not have when I died for the first time. I wanted food and sleep and a feeling of safety, a family where it would be okay. I wanted someone to tell you it would be okay, to explain it all, and to be there, to answer any question. We were too late with Booker. It took us so long to find him, and when we did, his family was breaking around him, and he was so angry about everything. I did not want that for you. I wanted to give you the chance to be okay. You turned out all right, she tells him. It's true. Even if she is still struggling to understand how every piece fits together to make up the puzzle of Nikki's existence, she can see clear enough what the final product has become. She doesn't know how a man can walk to war with cultural genocide as its goal, how he can be a part of rapes and murders and cannibalism, and emerge on the other side as the same kind of man who Sufi whirls and worries about whether she's happy. But even though the transition is blurred, he is consistent in it always. He has been the same person since they met, and it is only the extra background information that feels so brutally at odds with the person she knows. It hurt, Nikki tells her. For many years it hurt. It was confusing and painful, and I made many mistakes. I do not wish for you to have things that you regret in the end. I do not wish for you to experience things that makes you suffer or doubt any part of this world. So I am scared. Scared, too, that I am making it worse. I just don't understand, Niall says. I can't read your mind like Joe can. He smiles a little wryly at that assessment. I can't depend on 1,000 years' worth of interactions to get you, like Andy does, either. What you did to Lorenzo freaked me out. I've never seen someone do something like that before. And then you just smiled. I didn't want you to be scared of what happened, Nikki says. It made me scared of you. Oh. His shoulders slump even more. His head bends down. He bites his lip a little, then releases it. I am sorry I scared you, Niall. And then everyone knew you weren't okay, but you kept telling everyone you were fine, and I didn't know what was going on. I am sorry for that, too. Slowly, Niall reaches out. She takes his hand in hers. He looks back up, waiting patiently for her judgment. I was scared for you, too, she admits. I don't need you to protect me from everything. But I get that you want to. I understand why. So if it happens, then I get it. But just don't lie and say things are fine when they're not. I didn't lie, Nikki says. For me, then, and now, I am fine. Joe says you've been struggling since Merrick. Struggling, yes, but not suffering. If it gets worse, you'll know. What happened last night? Really, Niall, I'm fine. How? She asks him. How can you just shrug it off, then? It's not precisely the question she means to ask. She means to ask with different pronouns. How can I shrug it off? How can I let it go? But she doesn't try to edit it, and Nikki seems to truly be considering his answer. He takes a few moments to respond, a few moments where his nose scrunches and his hand becomes a bit firmer in her grasp. Joe, he says eventually. It is not the answer she wanted. He has stayed with me for so long that when I struggle, he is there, When I cannot manage on my own, he is there. It sounds dependent. Perhaps it is, but it means for me. When I am at my lowest point, I know he is there to help me come through to the other side. I don't have a Joe. I didn't have one either for many years. He gives her a look, waiting for her to catch up. And it feels like it all comes around on a loop when it does. Fears of her feeling alone, confused, lost, hurt. Fears of there being no one there to help her. "So you want to be my Joe?" she asks him. He shrugs a little. "Until you feel you can handle it on your own, or you find someone better to help." I feel like I've stumbled into a story as it's ending. Andy's dying. Booker's been exiled. And you and Joe are... you're both in this perfectly zen place of human understanding that I don't understand. You have this faith and this hope and this love for all the things in the world that I just... I feel like that's not me. You're all set, and I'm... "At your bad beginning," Nikki offers. Her shoulders slump, defeated. "Yeah." "Would you like to know a secret?" he asks her, shy and sweet. He squeezes her hand, and she nods a little. "It'll be worth it one day." "How do you know?" "Everyone besides you and Joe are miserable." "Because they haven't always been miserable, and they won't always be. Everything happens for a reason, and Niall, I truly believe that for you, all of this will be worth it. You'll get your happy ending, I promise you." "How can you promise me that?" "Because I'll help you, any way I can, for as long as you want or need." She sniffs loudly. There are tears in her eyes, and she needs to wipe at them, but it's so embarrassing to be caught out like this. He pulls her closer, and she falls against his chest. He wraps his arms around her, and he locks her in, safe and warm. "I will try to be more transparent." "Me too," she promises. So much of this has had so very little to do with Nikki directly. And yet, with everything happening, it had been easy to blame and accuse. And even despite that, he's here promising her a happy ending. "Did you ever doubt you'd have your happy ending?" she whispers to his chest. "Many times," he swears. He kisses the top of her head, fraternal and paternal in one. "But it happened anyway. You can doubt, too. I'll carry the hope for you, as long as you need, and then, one day, it will be yours." It's a good dream. It's hard right now. It feels impossible to truly put her faith in it. But Nikki holds her close, and as he holds her, she becomes aware of Joe and Andy slowly drifting in as well, joining in and keeping her safe and warm. She had been given a gift to be found so quickly. She knows that. She does. Perhaps, maybe they're right. Perhaps, even amongst the horror and darkness and hell of this existence, there is still beauty to be found. Perhaps it really is just hiding in the music and the art and the little things to love, the little things that she can permit herself to love, because when it becomes hard to focus or the pain becomes too strong, she is surrounded by those who are willing to carry her load. She breathes in deep. She holds them close, and she wills herself to believe. The end.